Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And in our last episode, we ran out of time. We were kind of diverged down this path of what if President Trump got elected, or if we had a constitutional president, actually, because even though President Trump gets elected, doesn't mean that he'll do this. But the question I posed, we got Paul with us, folks. So welcome back, Paul.
Thank you.
And so the question I posed, Paul, was what is the president's job?
And well, Go ahead.
And you answered it. You answered it, faithfully execute the laws of the union. And so when we look at the 16th Amendment, the 16th Amendment does not authorize the federal government unlimited power to spend money. Mm-hmm. It only changes its authority. And to be clear, folks, I need to download the congressional debates on the 16th Amendment as well as the 17th. Just due to the fact that I think there's a lot of people that have redefined these amendments, and there's clearly the federal government is that's their business in redefining everything they possibly can to empower themselves more and more. But when I look at what the president can do with the 16th Amendment, because they don't have the authority to spend money on things that they can't spend, then he should be able to actually reach into Congress and say, you can't spend that money. Or actually go to the Treasury and say, that money doesn't go there. That mm-hmm. money cannot be spent. Mm-hmm. And so the president has the power to ensure that the Treasury doesn't allocate that money. I mean, Congress can say that they want to, spend this money. The president's not required to spend money unconstitutionally.
This is an interesting point, GR. So picture this. The president vetoes something. This is unconstitutional. Congress overrides his veto, and the president can say to the Treasury, we're not spending this.
Right.
Whoa. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, they can pass the bill, but it doesn't. Mm-hmm. They can't force the president and his executive department to operate unconstitutionally. Now, see, here's the real problem. Mm-hmm. And this is why it really requires the states to do this, because when it comes to politics and political power, nobody passes up the opportunity to exercise political power with money. Mm-hmm. And so what would happen, because I can't see President Trump actually doing that. But what would happen, I think, is, the person that would obtain that money would, or they get Congress to spend that money, or Congress willingly spends the money, they would do what they could to redirect that money on something that, of their own unconstitutional and savory disposition to, help themselves financially. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even though Congress may be spending the money for doing, as a matter of fact, when we looked at the Iran-Contra situation,
right?
I mean, Congress said that you can't spend any money on doing that, but they did.
Right.
So, I mean, it doesn't mean that the president and that happened under Reagan.
I remember that.
And it plagued Reagan. It bothered him to his death that happened mm-hmm. under him, because he had delegated so much that those folks were running rogue, got away right. with it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, even though the president has the ability to enforce the Constitution, when you really peel it back, I mean, if he had he would have to fully arm the Department of Justice to go on a crusade. and literally remove anybody and everybody who fails to support the Constitution in accordance with in accordance with the Constitution itself. So, in other words, going and removing Supreme Court justices, federal justices, so forth, because you know you have to have at least two sides of the triangle, right? You got the judiciary and the executive to basically finally overpower the legislative, and that's a tough nut to crack. Why I state that the president's best chance is getting the states. That's why, when you really look at it, if you've seen Federalist Paper 49, Federalist Paper 49 talks about using, you know, an appeal to the people or to the states to basically deal with federal encroachments. Now, the Convention of States completely misinterpret, because they talk, he talks, and they actually cite Thomas Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia that I think he wrote in 1783, and he talks about using conventions to deal with overreach. And but clearly, when you read this, it talks about two different types of conventions. One to amend or change or to deal with the Constitution, its problems, deficiencies, or what have you, to make the necessary changes. The other convention is to deal with encroachments, to deal with the overreach, the breaches of the compact.
Okay.
In other words, that other convention is not an Article 5 convention. It is not anything to change or even address. It is to enforce the Constitution.
Is this in Federalist 49?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I've got it in front of me. I'll take a look.
Yeah, it's right there in the first paragraph. It's right there in the first paragraph. What's the title of Federalist Paper 49?
It says, "Method of guarding against the encroachments of any one department of government by appealing to the people through a convention from the New York Packet." Tuesday, February 5th, 17.
Okay, so read that first paragraph.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, what, did you want me to read the first paragraph?
Yeah, read the first paragraph.
This is okay. The author of the notes of the state of Virginia, so James Madison is writing this, and now he's quoting Thomas Jefferson, right? The author of the notes of the state of Virginia quoted in the last paper his subjoining to that valuable work the draft of a constitution which had been prepared in order to be laid before a convention expected to be called in 1783 by the legislature for the establishment of a constitution for that commonwealth. The plan, like everything from the same pen, marks a turn of thinking, original, comprehensive, and accurate, and is the more worthy of attention as it equally displays a fervent attachment to Republican government and an enlightened view of the dangerous propensities against which it ought to be guarded. One of the precautions which he proposes and on which he appears ultimately to rely as a palladium to the weaker departments of power against the invasions of the stronger is perhaps altogether his own, and is it, and as it immediately relates to the subject of our present inquiry, ought not to be overlooked. His proposition is, quote, that whenever any two of the three branches of government shall concur in opinion, each by the voices of two-thirds of their whole number, that a convention is necessary for altering the Constitution or correcting breaches of it.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's all caps, that last one.
It is all caps.
Okay, good. Okay, good.
Okay. A convention shall be called for the purpose, quote, now, as the people are the only legitimate fountain of power, and it is from them that the constitutional charter under which the several branches of government hold their power is derived, it seems strictly consonant to the Republican theory to recur to the same original authority, that not only whenever it may be necessary to enlarge, diminish, or new model the powers of the government, but also whenever any one of the departments may commit encroachments on the chartered authorities of the others.
Yes. Yeah, so, and he goes on, but he wrote this in 1783.
Mm-hmm.
This was in his book, The States, or the Notes on the State of Virginia. Now, here's a little factoid. That happened to be the best-selling book in America by an American author to that date.
Wow.
So, in other words, Jefferson, by publishing that one book, made a lot of money. Made some money. I shouldn't say made a lot of money, but made some money because that was the most purchased book, which is why the Anti-Federalists pointed it out. And so, specifically that line. And now, again, the title of this was Dealing with Encroachments and How to Do That. So did Thomas Jefferson understand the Article 5 Convention? As a matter of fact, in the Articles of Confederation, the convention was in the hands and in full control of the states. In other words, Continental Congress had no authority to call for a convention.
Okay.
They basically concurred with and agreed to the states, but the states, the commission had to come from the states to go forth and amend the Constitution. Because when you look at the document of the Articles of Confederation, the powers were vested in the states, not the federal government.
Okay, that's interesting. That goes back to the instructions that the states gave their delegates to put together a solution that would meet the exigencies of the Union. In other words,
correct.
Do what you need to do to fix this problem.
Correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. Okay.
Right. So in this particular context, the states had the authority in the Articles of Confederation. They didn't. And as a matter of fact, when that book was written, the Articles of Confederation were just being ratified.
Okay.
And so how many branches of government existed in the Articles of Confederation?
I'm trying to remember. I actually don't remember.
One. Continental Congress was the only branch of government.
Okay.
And so when he's speaking of the branches of government, he's talking about the disparate, the separate branches of government, the states themselves, the Continental Congress. And so they didn't have a judiciary. They didn't have a legislative. So Madison is kind of, you know, morphing this towards the Constitution.
Okay.
So when Madison includes two of the three, he's putting that into context to the U.S. Constitution, but that was not what Jefferson was intending. He was intending in dealing with a very single-dimensional government.
Organization.
Right. And so the point is that there is clearly, and this is what he, you know, cites here, where there are two types of actions. There is the action of altering. That's what he says right there, that a convention is necessary for altering the Constitution. Or, now he's talking about a convention, not a Article 5 convention, but a different type of convention for correcting breaches of it. So in other words, you have to get the parties to the compact in the room to either make the alterations or to enforce.
So this goes right to Republic Review.
It does. And as a matter of fact, it goes right to the resolutions, which is what we're halfway through when we started going through the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So, understanding that in 1798 is when the Alien Sedition Acts occurred, and that's when Madison and Jefferson jumped to and said, it is time to deal with the breaches of it, breaches of the contract, of the compact.
Okay.
And so, did the state of Kentucky or Virginia say, we're petitioning for an Article 5 convention to alter the Constitution?
No. What they did was, Kentucky outlined the problems. Virginia backed it up and invited the other states to participate. And so the term convention doesn't automatically, in the way they used it, didn't mean Article 5, and the term convention shouldn't automatically put in your mind Article 5 convention.
Well, so what does the word, right? What does the word convention mean?
It has a couple of meanings. One is to convene, to meet together for a particular purpose. And another term mean convention is a process of doing something. For example, if something is conventional.
Right.
You know,
right. And then there is and then the term convention is also an agreed upon process.
Okay.
So In other words, you know, it is unconventional for you to make, you know, your donuts that way. Mm-hmm. You know, the convention of making donuts would be this way.
Right.
Right. So in other words, using the word convention really speaks more to the proper methodology than it does, you know, a very unique outlier. So this is why, and, you know, not trying to throw hate out, but this is why those people who are, quote unquote, the Karens in the conservative side that, you know, actually just they go into a tizzy when you use the word convention, you know, it puts them into a position where they have no credibility because, oh, shoot, you use the word convention. You're trying to change the Constitution. Okay. And wow, I mean, it's almost like, you know, saying, you know, Mom, I love you. Then the next thing is somebody across the room, Oedipus complex, you know, what? Right. What? Where did that come from?
Right. Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure.
Anyway, so that's how crazy. And so when the progressives, let me just kind of grind on this a little bit. I appreciate your patience. So when you have the progressives who are basically creating and defining a very specific word to be bad, like conspiracy, oh, they conspired, this is a part of the conspiracy, then they've convinced everybody that when somebody uses the word conspiracy or they're conspired, that person's a wacko.
Right.
This is equally being used as just as evil as the progressives in the conservative movement. When you've got the John Birchers and all the other anti-convention, I'm against the Article 5 convention for the purpose for the very specific purpose of what they want to do. We've talked about amendments to the Constitution. I'm absolutely in favor of getting rid of the convention out of the Constitution.
You mean getting rid of the Article 5 convention?
That process, period. Correct. That process. Right. In other words, I'm okay with maintaining the Article 5 amendment process, but making it so that the states would never, ever convene so that we would ever be able to deviate, that only a minor amendment can be done.
So, real quick question, just, and this is on the subject, but it's straying a little bit. What was on their minds when this got put in there? What were you, do you know what I mean? I mean, I know we went over this in the ratification debates, but remind me, what were they thinking about? What was the impetus for even suggesting something like an Article 5 convention?
This was due, so they were afraid that the federal government would get to a point where they would refuse to give or create an amendment to the Constitution for something that they, and I'll give you a good case in point, the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the Constitution was sold and ratified on the concept that we didn't need a Bill of Rights.
Right.
And as soon as they started operating, day one, New York petitioned for an Article 5 convention to, you know, amend the Constitution. And within a week or two, Virginia did the same. And so this was because, you know, they didn't think that there was going to be any Article 5 or not. Or the Article 5 process wasn't going to be used to create a Bill of Rights and amend the Constitution. So the states didn't have any faith in the federal government in doing that. And so how big was that that Madison actually took that charge, ran his campaign on it, and actually executed that? That's huge. But the next turn in, what, 1792? I mean, we can go back and look at the date on it. I think it's 1792 when the 11th Amendment came out.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is right there. So the 11th Amendment came out in 1794. The states came along and said, hey, we want you to peel back your judicial jurisdiction over cases between, you know, a person of, a, you know, of another state suing a, a different state, a state that they don't reside in. And so the federal government had a choice. They could have either amended the Constitution because more and more of the states were saying, yeah, we want that amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So they did it. They amended the Constitution. Because it creates this consensus. This is why I actually counted through how many amendments the federal government has granted that actually was driven by the states. Over half of them.
Right.
Over half. Because that line is in the Constitution. Because that was the fear of the federal government if they went into a convention again, that there would be a rewriting of that Constitution. You see, the only time the Constitution becomes wholesale editable, in other words, from the beginning to end, complete change, because, see, you can't create an amendment that could rewrite. The Congress doesn't have the power to rewrite the Constitution. They can only make a minor change here or there or something like that. I mean, because the states wouldn't let it. But you get the states in the room. Now that whole Constitution becomes clay and it can be completely reformed. That is the only time that the Constitution is that vulnerable to that type of change. That's the only time. And so we need to be, I mean, Madison was really clear. You need to be very, very careful when you get all the states into the room, you know, with that Constitution and remodeling it, because they may actually redo it altogether.
Yes.
Now, what it would do, what that would do is that that would destroy the Union, because there'd be several states that would still say, we're not going to follow that. We're not going to do that. Right. And even though Article 5 clearly states that regardless of what comes out of that convention, it still requires a 3/4. The John Birch said, well, they could change that. Well, they can't, because the Article 5 process actually requires that whatever comes out of that convention still requires a 3/4 ratification process.
Sure.
Okay. So there's a little hyperbole on both sides. But bottom line, both of these organizations, the conventionites and the anti-conventionites, or I should say those organizations that make up those two sides, have really got everybody to think it is a binary issue, that the only process is a convention, when no, this is a compact, and the process has nothing to do with, or the problem and the solution to the problem has nothing to do with whether we change or alter the Constitution. It has everything to do with enforcing the Constitution, that second process that Jefferson mentioned, correcting the breaches thereof.
Right.
So, anyway, now
we've got seconds. Right?
Yeah, we have less than a minute to now cover the 17th Amendment. Now, the 17th Amendment is an amendment that was driven by the states, because by this point in time, by the early 1900s, there were progressive states that were refusing to seat their senators. In other words, the state legislatures were not appointing senators to go to the Senate.
And when we get back from the break, I'd like to know why. You know, that is some consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so it may have had something to do with quorum, and it may have had something very specifically to do with the progressive movement actually getting out of hand at the state level in these progressive states, because it was the progressive states that were seeking this. So when we come back after this promo, we'll dive into it. Now, I don't have all of the details regarding the 17th Amendment. I've been clear on the disclosure of this, But I do remember talking to John Ehrweil about this. So, folks, we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so going into the break, we were talking about the progressive states actually pushing forward in getting the 17th Amendment passed by basically throwing it out to the people. And so by this point in time, democracy, the smacks of democracy were just, oh, this was just great. The paradigm, as a matter of fact, had completely shifted. America wanting their representation. Well, everybody wanted more representation. And everybody thought that obtaining representation in the Senate would improve things. However, what they did was, because the way the Constitution was framed, was the Senate was to represent the states. Now, there's no doubt in my mind, because when we look at the language, they didn't change that. As we look at the language of the 17th Amendment, the 17th Amendment clearly changed the method of how the senators were to be selected. It didn't change their responsibility. So when it comes to recalling and being able to actually remove a sitting U.S. senator, the state house should still have that authority. Now, I'm not sure if Paul's with us, because he might, you know, he might have gone on break or might have muted himself. But
I didn't go on break.
Okay.
I was talking.
Oh, okay. So,
yeah,
we couldn't hear what you said. So go ahead and say it again.
Sorry. So I was concurring with what you were saying, that the states, I found it interesting that you said that the states may still be able to recall a senator. That would be kind of, that would certainly be shaking the tree.
Right. So so all the states would need to do was they would just need to put it into their constitution that the U.S., unless the constitution's changed, I would just bury it into the state constitution that all U.S. senators that are, you know, selected, however they're selected, to represent the state, not the people, which means the state legislature, they just need to go in and define that and empower themselves the ability to remove that senator. Because Article 5 demands it. So when we look at Article 5, and I'm just going to jump right up there to Article 5. The very last part of Article 5 states this, that there be no, let me see here. That's the Fifth Amendment. Article 5 is right here. Okay, so it says that no state, okay, so provided that no amendment which shall be made, and then blah, 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 that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. So they can demand that they have that representation because Article 5 protects that.
That is brilliant. Well, that's what it says.
Mm-hmm.
If the states, so states need to remind senators that they're still answerable to the states.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, they may be selected differently.
Yep.
But, oh man, boy, well that.
The state can actually undo the election process and go back to appointing. Say we're not going to recognize this anymore.
Right.
Right.
Especially the states that voted against the amendment.
Yes.
Because they chose not.
But the beautiful thing is Biden. I was going to say
Biden.
Biden. Biden opened the door. That's mm-hmm. the O part. Opened the door to actually allow states to change their positions on that.
Right.
Right. Now, what happened, folks, is in 2010, when they found out, when they realized, because they didn't even know. These guys are so illiterate regarding the Constitution. They didn't realize that Delaware actually rejected the 17th Amendment. And Biden just goes, are you kidding me? You know, we're a progressive state. That was a progressive earmark. I mean, that was a hallmark for progressivism in America. Mm-hmm. And so he convinced them to change their position and convinced the federal government to allow that change to occur.
So guess what?
They opened the door for everybody else to be able to do the same thing.
Now, I think the point we should make is this is probably amendment by amendment. It doesn't mean that it opens the door for any state to change any amendment. You're right?
Right, correct.
To change your position.
It only on that particular amendment. Right.
Right. Because, correct. For example, on the 14th Amendment, there are arguments that these states rescinded their amendment, but by what did the federal government accept that?
Well, so actually,
in other words, what was the convention or conventional way to manage that? Remember?
Yeah. So there were states that never did ratify until much later.
Okay.
But the states that already ratified, then tried to change it, they were recorded as ratifying, period.
Okay. They were not recorded as.
To my knowledge, they did not record them as changing their position. That's one of the reasons. So they created this great national debate. In my mind, there had to have been a great mm-hmm. national debate. Can a state rescind its ratification?
Right. Well, now that question is going on with the Article 5 Convention.
Okay.
Right? Because there are states who have, well, they've rescinded their call. It's not a ratification. They have rescinded their call to the convention.
Oh, really?
Right. Yeah, you didn't know?
No. What states have done that?
Hang on a minute. Let me look that up because I understand that there are a couple states.
All right.
I'll look it up, GR, while you're... Okay.
I'll tell you what. Let's move forward with the 17th and you look it up.
Okay.
I will read the first paragraph. So this is the first paragraph of the 17th Amendment, that the Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. In other words, I have no idea why they included that last sentence, because there was no change to the electors in this amendment. I mean, they only needed that one sentence. Because
go ahead. Of the most numerous branch, the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch, that would be the House of the state legislature.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Right.
So we don't know why that's there. You know, it would help to have.
So if you go to Article 1, Section 2, this is what it says. The electors in each state. Yeah, you compare it. I'll read it and you compare it to what it says. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature.
That's already in the Constitution.
Okay.
Why would they repeat that?
Right.
I don't know.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so anyway, this just goes to prove, you know, the shadiness of what they were trying to do. So the next part of this is, when vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority of each state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies, provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by election as the legislature may direct.
You know, shortly after Susan and I were married, I got a promotion. We moved to West Virginia for a little while, and that is the year that Jay Rockefeller was the governor of West Virginia. I don't know if you remember this, but there was a vacancy in the Senate, and he appointed himself to it.
Oh, well, that was fortuitous, wasn't it?
It was. Okay, it was really interesting. In fact, I want to make sure that I'm not, you know, telling a tale, but I remember it clearly because, boy, that seems strange, you know. When we get to it, I found a list of rescissions for the Article 5 convention application. Hang on a minute. Let me see. Senate. Yep. Governor of West Virginia.
Okay. Wes, did you happen to find out any states that have rescinded their position?
So here's what it says. It says, list of state legislative rescissions from 88 to 2023. It's listing Alabama, Florida, Louisiana, Idaho, Oregon, North Dakota, Utah, Arizona. It's listing a number of states with some details.
Okay.
Virginia rescinding in 2004, Montana rescinding in 2007, Oklahoma in 2009. Wow. Sure, there's a lot of – I need to study this a little more deeply.
Okay, all right.
Because they've got a lot of detail for each one of these. But it says there are unsuccessful efforts to rescind, but then there are others – that is showing as state legislative rescissions.
Okay. So let's move on.
Okay.
So on the 17th Amendment, there's no language whatsoever, folks, where the senators' responsibility of how they're supposed to vote. Mm-hmm. Remember, we elect our representatives in this Republican form of government, and the senators' representatives are the state legislatures. Even though they're chosen by the people, they are still supposed to be offering the suffrage for their state legislatures. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, then the Senate, this would be enough evidence for me. The state legislature actually provide very specific guidance for each of these senators that you will vote, you know, for this candidate for the court. You're going to, you know, vote, you know, against this treaty and so forth. And when they don't go down that path and actually vote for the state legislature, as the state legislature specifically directed them, then they remove them.
Mm.
Because they have the right of suffrage. Those senators are to vote for them, not for themselves or their own political agenda.
Whoa.
That's the whole point of a representative government, is not to create a bunch of little dictators that are willing to go into a pool of fellow dictators and all compromise and seize all power.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Constitution does actually state in Article 5, that these states are guaranteed that suffrage.
Mm-hmm.
So, but The last part of this is that this amendment shall not be so construed as to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as part of the Constitution.
Okay. So it's not, we're not changing the election process for senators.
That is correct.
Or the select. Okay.
Okay. So.
Okay.
So now, what we've got is we've got the 18th Amendment.
I should before I go on, before we get away from this, I want maybe the audience to know that you wrote a paper about the 17th Amendment, and we haven't brought that up.
Yes.
Remember?
Yep.
What's it entitled to? Because I have shared it with a couple of legislators.
Rescinding the 17th Amendment?
Right. Rescinding the 17th Amendment. I know we talked about it, but there's a document on your website about rescinding the 17th Amendment. Mm-hmm. And I just, and it really clearly lays out what the power is that the people in the states have. Okay. And why it's weak. So I didn't want that to go by. We can go to 18 now, but I wanted to, you know, point the audience to, to your documentation.
All right. So the 18th Amendment, now the movement for the 18th Amendment began in the
1800s. The 1800s?
Yes. Yeah, because it became more and more of an outcry, more of a myopic issue for, I'll just say, the religious right, because they looked at alcohol, now that we started obtaining refrigeration, and now that we started, you know, getting advancements with technology, a person, you know, didn't need to, couldn't justify as much to have all that liquor and beer and so forth. And so they saw America being kind of consumed by, you know, the hair of the dog that was biting it was alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, you know, it took a while. If you actually go through the prohibition movement, the prohibition really started, that movement started in the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took a long time to get enough women really, because it was really a woman's movement, because they kind of saw the men as becoming slovenly and drunkards and so forth.
Right.
And they finally won. They finally got a point to where they, you know, had enough support for this amendment that the states actually persuaded and ratified this amendment. Now, it was, you know, it was that beautiful, you know, guile of the devil. Oh, well, we're just taking away the strong drink. You can still get drunk on wine and beer, but you just can't be harmful, you know, hurting yourself anymore with a hard liquor. So 1719, they proposed it. And in 1917,
right.
It was proposed. And in 2 years, it was ratified.
That's quick.
That was quick. And it was post-World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And so go ahead. Section 1.
Section 1. After 1 year from the ratification of this article, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors within, the importation thereof into, or the exportation thereof from the United States in all territories subject to the jurisdiction thereof for beverage purposes is hereby prohibited.
Okay. Section 2.
All right. The Congress and the several states shall have concurrent power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation.
Okay, so there. How are they going to enforce it?
Well, the ideal way to have enforced it would probably have been by the
militia. Well, no. Based on the language here, how are they to enforce it?
It says the Congress and the several states shall have concurrent power
to enforce this article by
appropriate legislation,
by law. Okay. In other words, they can now create law in pursuance to this. So they can create a law regarding the manufacturing. They can create a law regarding the sale. They can create a law regarding the transportation and, you know, and exportation. Okay?
We talked about this kind of clause and others, but this is the first time to say Congress and the several states.
Right.
Okay, she'll have concurrent power to enforce this article. Okay.
Okay, so it means that both the states and the federal government can create laws in enforcing the actions of this. Does it say anywhere here where the federal government then has the authority to establish a police force?
No.
To establish a standing army, in putting it into the terms of the Constitution when it was defined, that was defined as a standing army. In other words, creating an enforcement agency would be a standing army, because currently the Constitution, when this was being written, currently the Constitution still states, and still does today, they've never created the quote-unquote authority to create a standing army for enforcing a given law or sets of laws. So the only methodology of actually enforcing the laws passed, the legislation passed by both the state and by the federal government, is via that militia or via that enforcement agency, because the only enforcement agency that the federal government has, because it states right there, Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15, or whatever, 14, that they shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. So when they create laws, the execution of those laws is to be done by
the militia.
Correct. So going out and creating the ATF and the FBI, did they have the authority to do that?
They did not.
They did not. There we go, folks. And so the third part, maybe it's in the third part. We got a third part to this. Go ahead.
Okay, let's see what it says. This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of the several states as provided in the Constitution within 7 years from the date of the submission hereof to the states by the Congress. I think this is the first one with an expiration date.
Yes, it is. So they actually put an expiration on it. They felt that by putting an expiration on it and just letting it linger to its death would convince more people to actually ratify this amendment than not. So the ERA, they did the same thing.
Okay.
Right.
And it went to its death, is my guess.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get to that when we get, because I have all the failed amendments in here too.
Oh, okay.
We've been going through them, but so far, most of them, I mean, when we covered Jefferson's, right, his 1803 amendment.
Yes.
And we covered Lincoln's amendment that he signed that, you know, died on the vine. So there's a lot more amendments now. As a matter of fact, we now have more failed amendments, you know, in the last century than, you know, those in the previous century. So just to be clear, moving on, there was no authority whatsoever for the 17th Amendment to authorize the federal government to create any enforcement agency.
Right.
But they did. They created, based on this particular amendment, they created the FBI and the ATF. Okay?
Okay.
Any debates on that? Then, okay, moving forward.
No, it's the only thing I might add is, you know, if the FBI and ATF were to have any power at all, it would only be within Washington, D.C., is my guess, right?
Correct. The only place where they would be able to man their own police force, like the ATF and the FBI, would be in the District of Columbia and or territories of the United States.
Sure, where they have the right to exclusive legislation.
But technically, in the territories, they have the responsibility of making sure those territories are on the path of becoming states. They don't have the authority to, you know, perpetually maintain territories.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
And the states really need to hold them to that, to say, hey, look, either you get rid of that territory, trade it away, you know, set it off to become its own autonomous nation, or it it will be integrated into the United States. We're not paying to basically, you know, allow you to, you know, provide unconstitutional welfare to the people of Puerto Rico.
Sure.
So, because that's what they've been doing. So the 19th Amendment, now we got time, we've got 3 minutes for this. So the 19th Amendment proposed in 1919, ratified in 1920. Go ahead.
Okay. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. So this was women's suffrage.
Yes, it was. But why did they use the term sex instead of gender? Excuse me. Sorry.
I think I would imagine that was probably the more common word. It doesn't seem unusual to me.
Was it the scientific word of the time? Yes, it was.
I would guess that it was.
Yeah,
sure.
And so to create something that would deviate from the black and white or the binary version of sex would be gender.
Okay. Incidentally, notice this one was proposed in 1919 and ratified the following year.
Yes, that quick.
That was fast.
Yeah, it was very quick. Okay. That's just because Wyoming had already passed it, and there were other states in the Union. I think Utah and a couple of other states had already passed those laws. So now they were just going to say, okay, well, we might as well make that happen too. The federal government didn't need to.
Okay.
They didn't need to. They didn't need to go down that path to do that. You see my point? The only reason that they felt necessary is because maybe a state might go backwards.
Okay.
So it creates a permanent, it transfixes, or it basically, you know, imposes that as a permanent right. So the next one, and again, go ahead. Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. In other words, now they can create laws to guarantee this. Now, the next one is an amendment that came forward in
1926.
So clearly, Teddy Roosevelt, during his tenure, created the Department of Commerce and Labor. And so the Commerce and Labor Department quickly got divided after he created, you know, commerce and labor. They were quickly divided, like within a couple of years. And the federal government was coming along trying to create these laws and regulations. And as a matter of fact, there were the sick chicken law and some of these other, you know, laws that were being passed that were dealing with labor. And
the sick chicken law?
Yeah. So we just ran out of time. You can ask about that in the next episode, and I'll remind you. But folks, we've made it. We're in 1926 to an unratified amendment before we hit the 20th Amendment. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in
in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.